I'm opening? We have an eye, part of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro, this is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Anatomy of a Movie for A Most Wanted Man. I really enjoyed this movie. This is Philip Seymour Hoffman's last completed movie. Of course, we've got The Hunger Games coming up, and I don't think he's in another movie besides that, or maybe he is.
There might be one other movie, but I don't think it was completed as this, as A Most Wanted Man.
And and certainly, you know, with A Most Wanted Man, he is the lead character.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought, for me, in 2014, this is one of the more better movies.
Absolutely.
This really stood out. Rewatchability factor isn't as great, but I would.
Yeah, I would too.
But it was amazing.
Yeah, I would too. Dimitri, hey movie fans. This movie, watching it, as you watch it, well, number one, it plays like a Jean Le Carré novel. So it has all those elements. And his novels come about from, he was an actual spy. So they come from experience, and he wrote them as an anti-James Bond, so to speak, going, you know, he knew that James Bond, that's not spy. He goes, this is what it is to be a spy, working through political red tape. And so there are common themes in his novels and movies that have been made. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, Spy Who Came In From the Cold. This one is no different. We have our broken protagonist. It is... Who's dealing with something that happened in the past. He's sort of kind of put out to pasture. It is deliberately paced. A lot of, quote-unquote, there is a lot of spying going on. But the movie dragged me in. It slowly brought me in where I started paying attention more and more. Right off the bat, way more linear than Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy movie was.
And that also had more characters.
Absolutely.
Overall.
Absolutely.
This, you just, you know, you follow him for the most part. He's your guy.
Yeah, and so for those who might be, for those where Tinker Tailor may have scared you off, hopefully you've watched this one, Most Wanted Man, and you're saying to yourself, okay, I can follow this. More linear story. We have a great character. And by the end, I was really involved and wrapped into this movie, and I came out going, wow, for those people who are thinking, you know, we've got too much blow-em-up movies, too much big movies, which I don't have any problem with, this is a good-thinking man's spy flick, and I think it works on the adult level, and it really is worth viewing and watching, especially if you want something a little bit different than your typical summer fare.
And that's interesting that you note that, because right off the bat, there's that title card, right? And so if you're coming in a little bit late, you miss what the crux of the movie is.
Correct.
Which is, if these events don't have, if these events kind of perspire in the way that we don't want it to happen, a huge explosion will happen, i.e. 9/11.
Right.
But we never get that on screen, but that's the implication right at the end when he says, fuck. You know, everybody else just went for that easy out, and he was on the cusp of really preventing something. And, you know, obviously we'll talk about the amazing speech, but that's what he was fighting for.
Absolutely.
But we never had to, we knew the stake, and we never had to even see it.
Yeah, and credit to that title card. Sometimes they're superfluous. Like, you know, it's just setting something up. It's exposition or sometimes unnecessary exposition. This title card set everything up that you understood where the movie may be going and what's going on. And I felt that it worked. I thought it was great. And from beginning to end, from meeting Gunther, our character, and what's going on, I just thought that it worked really well. Very, very well. So
absolutely. You know, and I really loved, I mean, in terms of using With Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, it's always tough for me to get those four sequentially. So if I mix them, the order up, forgive me. But like, the setting was very much a character as well.
Absolutely.
With this, Germany was very much a character, and I really appreciated that. Because that was part of the whole spy game, right? James Bond, it plays to its surroundings as well, but in this sense, you know, it was where it was much slower. It impacted our guys in a more negative sense than a James Bond.
Sure. No, I thought the setting was used fantastically in the way that it was shot. I kept on thinking about David Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and how he films and how he films Sweden. Even in the Sweden miniseries, so to speak, of that too, Sweden played as much a character in the movie. You know, in the Fincher movie, it was just a wonderful character because it added so much atmosphere to what was going on. And I had a throwback to that as I was watching this because Germany, where they were, and the gloom and the way that it was shot, it was a character. It lent to what was happening on screen and to the depression. Yeah, I really felt that location shooting, the way that it was shot, really just added to... what do I want to say? It was just the way in which it pulled me into the movie too, like,
because you had to
take your eyes off the screen.
You had the different sectors, and you know, there was the slums, there was kind of the in between, there was the political sectors, you know, which are upper class, you know, so, and obviously religion, divided, a lot of those things, or so, you know, obviously that's what they played to. And I really liked it. And, you know, for me, one of the standout things, obviously Philip Seymour Hoffman, we'll talk about him in a little bit, but, if you haven't seen, there's a great movie called Goodbye Lenin, and, the kid who kind of sets all this up, you know, by seeing the train station kind of handoff.
Right.
He's the star in Goodbye Lenin, and I thought he did a great job, obviously in that movie, but also in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's what jumped out at me, and I was excited to see him. And although not big, you know, not as big in this movie, I thought he did a great job.
Yeah, and everybody, big or small, we talked about just before we started recording. We were talking about Daniel Brühl, and one of my one small complaint is I wish there was more of him in there. You know, the part is a small part, but wherever he was in it, he was really good. You know, I thought the acting in this, and again, we'll talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman. I thought a lot of these people, that was another great thing. I actually felt that I was somewhere else because there were a lot of unrecognizable people to me. So, you know, with the exception of Daniel Brühl, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Rachel McAdams. A lot of the other people I am not too familiar with at all. So that brought this freshness to this movie, and I got to pay attention to different actors and see how they perform. I loved the woman that was more or less his partner. I really liked her. I liked that actress a lot. Nina Hoss as Erna Frey. I thought she was really good. And again, it's nice to see fresh new faces other than, you know, when we're in summertime, we're seeing a lot of action stars or just movie stars. In A Most Wanted Man, I did feel like I was someplace else. And one of the aspects of the movie that I really liked.
And, you know, I love examining the obsession of something like this, right? We've seen not The Hurt Locker, but Zero Dark Thirty. That, to me, was a great movie. Where it differs from this is obviously there was the climax of that where we, you know, without spoiling, you can imagine what happens at the end. They get Osama, right? So we cut away a large portion of that movie from the protagonist. Whereas this, you know, really follows that person. But it's the obsession of trying to do this, you know, accomplish a goal and not having any social life and how one handles that. I would say in Zero Dark Thirty, she handles it a little bit better than Philip Seymour, you know. Sure, he's doing one of the most, you know, admirable things that, you know, or at least on paper. But him as a character, he has so many lines of like, "Yeah, I know that bar well too well."
Mm-hmm.
You know, more than I should, at least.
And again, let's not forget the fact too that his character Gunther, typical Jean Le Carré, he is a broken protagonist. I mean, he is in the position that he's in because of a a foul up that happened that wasn't even necessarily his fault, and in a Berlin mission, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Okay. And basically, he's just thrown to the weeds, and this situation comes up, and there's a bit of a redemption quality to this movie. His obsession on making things right and doing it the right way, and fighting the clutter and the red tape, and trying to get people on his side. The desperation that this man was going through, and we see how it takes a toll on this character, which again, layer upon layer, you really sympathize and you follow him, and you want him to make good, even though we don't even really know what happened in that botched mission. He took the blame unfairly.
Well, one of the things, perhaps it is making a political statement. I don't know if whether or not it's overt, but what I took out of it, they wanted him to fail.
Yeah.
Okay, but by him failing, there's dire consequences to that, and that's to me was just so alarming, but obviously a big point of it, that I was just baffled at.
Yeah, and again, that's another theme that runs through these types of novels, and it was in Tinker Tailor. You could see that where people weren't rallying up against, they weren't rallying for Smiley to necessarily put together the pieces of the puzzle because they knew what it was going to mean at the end. Spy Who Came In From the Cold had something similar. His novels always bring you in, and now these movies, or this movie brings you in with the character, and again, it makes you go on that journey. Because in a sense, at this point, you want to see the redemption. He is an underdog. You see, he's battling so many people, and people really hate him for his ideals. And yet, when his team forms around him and says, "We're with you," you go, okay, there is some merit to this guy. And you want him to succeed over all these odds in breaking up this potential terrorist cell. And how he's methodically going to attack it.
And that's the other part of it is, how many times where, let's say it's out of school, right? Hey, we need to make improvements out of school. And so you see superintendents and things like that make decisions on behalf of the school without even talking to the teachers. And that is to say, these guys are in the trenches every day. And yet when they have their final meeting of, he has all the evidence, my team has put this report together, and they just go against him, even though, as he says, it's the great line, and it's in the trailer, it takes a minnow to catch,
to catch like a funnel, and then, and it's like, I don't know how to fish. And it's like,
you're not getting
the metaphor. We'll go back to, it's over your head. But
that's because he's not in the trenches on a daily basis, and these decisions are being made by people who don't understand it.
And I also, tell me if you agree with this, I think it's to the other people around. His agenda is to stop this terrorist act, that to make the place a safer place. That's his agenda. The other people, they were in it for themselves. They had their own agenda and what they wanted to do with thwarting this. It wasn't necessarily for the common good. It was to either try to elevate themselves in the eyes of other superiors, or the Americans wanted this because they wanted the stature or whatever. And oh my God. And Jesus, when he learns of that botched Berlin job, that it was the Americans that did it. She admits to him, Robin Wright Penn, who's fantastic. She admits to him that, "We know it wasn't your fault. We just let you take the fall. It was our fault." And you're just like, how much more shit can you pile on this guy? The mere fact that he just doesn't throw his hands up in the air and says, "You know what? F all he is, I'm going home." But he's got the tenacity and he wants to prove himself to everybody, including to himself, because he knows he's not a failure.
The other aspect of that is, it's one thing, when you're fighting against what we've been saying, but then also, yes, you mentioned that his team was behind him, but you have to convince, and then these other people to kind of get behind you, or at least push them through blackmail or whatever else, to do certain tasks that you need to get done. And even though deep down it's right, you still feel bad about forcing people to do something in that vein. Even when he's embracing you know, the kids, the father's son, mm-hmm. right? That they're ultimately gonna get the money too,
right?
You know, how many times is that, you know, they embrace so many times and like, you know, this needs to be done and things like that. And he's, right. you know, and he's trying to convince not only the kid that, you know, this is right, but
right.
that what he's pushing this kid to do is ultimately okay, even though obviously it's good for the greater
cause,
sure. but may not be directly good for him.
And it puts the kid, Abdullah's son, nice twist, by the ways. Because if memory serves, that character, which is Rashid, I believe, yeah, Rashid, that character is introduced sort of kind of early on, and you just note, you know, he's an informant, you know, yeah. he gets, and it's not until later in the movie that you realize that it's his dad, Abdullah, that's the main target that they're going for. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't see that coming. And when he's like, you know, it's my father, I can't do this, you know, they're going to find me out. And when Philip Seymour Hoffman coaxes him into continuing on being his informant, it set up a little sense of danger because a relationship with the father. But I also felt, geez, this kid could get killed, because if he was ever caught, instant yeah. death, regardless of it being his dad or not.
Yeah.
So I liked how how this story raised that stakes. And you're right, pushing him into coercion. Philip Seymour Hoffman knew what the outcome could be for this kid, but he needed him to get his job done.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And great. You know, so it's all these levels just weighing in on him.
Mm-hmm.
So I really love that. It was so wonderful
Me
to
too.
See. Why don't we, you want to kind of, obviously we've been touching upon that it is a book. Obviously there's been other books that have been adapted mm-hmm. into this. So, you know, it's not Transformers.
No.
None of these are ever going to break $1 billion,
no.
but, it has found its audience. And I think people, you know, I don't know, do you know how many books offhand there are? Because I think people will look forward to...
Well, Jean Le Carré, I don't know, we can look it up. I don't know exactly how many. The guy has a library of books mm-hmm. that he has written. And I think perhaps some of the most famous are the Smileys, the Smiley books. You know, I had read A Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and such. I enjoy his, you know, I enjoy reading his novels. Again, they're a break from reading science fiction. You know, I even enjoy reading James Bond novels. They're different. And like I say, this movie plays out, as well as like Spy Who Came In From the Cold. What's great about these movies is that they're really good adaptations in which they capture the spirit and the atmosphere of the book.
Yep.
And we have to say, I always like to say, and I can use it two ways, this movie is deliberately paced, okay? It's not fast. There aren't huge car chases. It's not quickly edited, so to speak. It's deliberately paced. It tells its story. Sometimes if I'm talking about a movie and I say it's deliberately paced, I use it as sarcasm. Not in this case. I think the deliberately paced aspect of this movie only builds up the suspense, so that when we get to that end, man, it's a punch in the gut. It's like, oh,
yeah.
And but yet there has its moments of suspense. The cart that when they're chasing the spies,
To me, the initial, you know, when they're walking, and then he pulls up. I thought for a minute he was just gonna straight hit them with the car.
Yeah, yeah.
But they, you know, they kind of get away. He chases, and you know. And it's so funny because, you know, as try as he might, but he's also not physically in shape to chase after these people.
No. And just the way how it starts with various spies all over the place and subway, and they're getting on and off subways. And that scene was a very suspenseful chase scene that used planes, trains, but trains, on foot, automobiles. And it was really done well. And again, I think because when you're a slow-paced movie like this, a scene like that grabs you more because it's a change of pace, and you're like, oh, okay, this is happening, and I'm following this through, and you don't know how the outcome's going to be.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen in the traditional sense as well. So that when we get to things at the end, and I like how it just builds up the character of everybody involved.
That's right. I mean, not that movies that move at a different pace and have perhaps more dialogue don't, you know, have great cinematography and great storytelling, but it's just, it forces you to differently examine whether it be a performance and, you know, how aware you are on a subconscious level. Mm-hmm. You know, that depends on what you're fully looking into it, but it forces a different type of response. And, you know, I love movies that the story is told visually.
Yeah.
And how that can, you know, work in its favor. And this is, By not having long stints of dialogue, uh-huh, that's what it forces you to do. It forces you to visually just intake and make your own observations.
Sure. And it allows you to, because of it being not cut a lot, it allows you to take everything in. And I find that sometimes, if done correctly, it actually builds character. Because sometimes the shot will linger on an actor, actress, and an expression will change, or you get a hint of something. And if it stays on the character long enough without cutting to something else, I find that it intensifies the atmosphere that we're in, and you get a better sense of character and what that character may or may not be thinking. There's a great scene at the bar. There were a couple of good
Which
scenes
one?
At the bar. Yeah, I was going to say, there were, and he, you just like, sometimes I like it when a camera just stays on people and they talk. They're acting, mm-hmm, but it's as if they're talking. And, you know, this movie lets scenes play out. And I think that's such an asset to this movie. And again, it just draws you in deeper. You pay attention more. You pay attention to, like, what we were talking about, the scenery and everything around you and how it lends to a particular scene.
Well, it's interesting because visually, you can obviously be close, you know, to what's going on. Sure. But from a perspective, for lack of a better term, you couldn't be more farther, right? Mm-hmm. So every time he's whether having his drink or his cigarette and he's looking out into the city or whatever he may be doing, you're always like, okay, what is going through his mind?
Mm-hmm.
And you're left pondering, and that leaves you at such a distance, especially with him, that I think it works in his favor because you ultimately end up caring more about him because you're like, okay, what is it about him?
Yeah, and he always has... He rarely is smiling in this movie. And you're right. And I think so many movies, things are explained to us, which is fine. Like, you know, we just talked about Guardians of the Galaxy, right? and we had such a good time talking about that movie. This movie is so different than that. It's like the opposite of Guardians of the Galaxy. Yet you're right. I'll sit there if he's looking out a window smoking a cigarette, just looking at Philip Seymour Hoffman, Gunther. You're like wondering what is going on. And he too is ragged. He's very ragged at this point, and we get to see his changes as well. Physically, this guy is, as you said earlier, not in the best of shape, and he does not look good. He doesn't look healthy. Shouldn't be doing the job that he's put into doing, but he's going to finish the job, and hopefully he'll come out on top.
And, yeah, For I also love the idea of that we talked about they're on the ground level,
mm-hmm,
but that they're so ragtag, you know, with Zero Dark Thirty. I would say in terms of hierarchy and politics or military, whatever you want to prefer in this case, these guys are to me almost right at the bottom, but the job they're tasked to do is of such importance.
And again, it's another theme in Jean Le Carre novels, too. They're a team. They're a team that has worked with each other. They have respect for one another. And again, if you watch, like, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, pardon me, there's always that scene that takes place at the long table where the team is somewhat involved and all the other government players. You've got the CIA, the Secret Service over here, FBI over here, and they're all giving their ideas and they have to hand in their reports. And when he has his team together, you're right. They're the odd man out compared to everybody else who's like prim and proper, very professional. They're very like, and they just don't like them.
Yeah.
They just don't like them. And they understand that they work differently and they don't understand what spy work is. And he tries to tell them, look, you got to take your time on this. This is what, you know, and trying to explain that is also like hitting your head up against a brick wall. And I love the distinction. It's like how they look so much different than the people who are supposed to really know what they're doing. And, you know, you get these ragtag team over here just trying to work things through and do it right.
Yeah.
You know, and they have and also, constant battle.
Also, the idea of going off of the smallest little thing and you just have to believe in it. There's that, I keep bringing up Zero Dark 30, but she's trying, you know, right before they're about to, I guess, well, because it would be historical, tell Obama, like, hey, we have him. Do you want to go for this? Yay or nay? They ask her, how sure are you? She says, okay, well, you guys don't believe in certainty, so 90%. But I mean actually 100. So in this case, you know, the whole notion is that these funds will go to...
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know.
he's going to have to... Okay, so, you know, you saw the movie. So Abdullah, who goes under a very, very prominent college professor, and he gives to many charities, but he's the prime suspect in a major terrorist ring. And our ragtag team, Philip Seymour Hoffman, they've sort of kind of figured out that there's this one boating company that seems to get onto his charity list, and it's always at the last minute, but they're not 100% sure. And that scene is like, again, that's a great way to build up suspense, because when they're trying to get him, you know, they get him set up. We have all this money. We want to put it, you know, it's yours. Put it in the cherries that you want. He provides his original list. And then at the day of signing, it's like, okay, this is fine. This is fine. And our heroes are in the van. And you're like, oh, if he doesn't change to that boating company,
everything
all bets are off.
Yeah.
So, and then when he does it, I let out a breath. I was like, phew. Like, yeah. Even though I sort of kind of knew that was going to happen.
It's amazing, but it's all because it's all real time. Even the checking, you know, they kind of speed it up to a slight degree by having some cuts here and there. But for the most part, what's his name?
Abdullah?
No,
or
the lawyer.
The banker?
The banker.
Or Willem Dafoe.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. I had it on the tip of my tongue. You know, when he's typing that in, let me make sure it checks out, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And just the sound effects, everything works in unison of just the keyboard typing, you know, and you can hear like the tab or the click going to the next portion, you know, first name, last name, bank, information, blah, blah. Okay, it checks out. And even before that, it's just that, you know, I think for me, as we're talking about sound effects, they really have to be complimented because you have nothing to go off in that room except for him signing his name 60 times.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know how they ask you to initial sometimes? This is a full signature on every one of those little bits.
And then at the end, when he says, oh, I have a last minute change. They're going, oh, what is it? And he says, oh, the so-and-so boating company. You know, you have the congratulatory shot in the van. Sort of, they're patting themselves on the back. But then when he's given the papers, that actor who plays Abdullah takes a pause. And I was like, God damn it, just sign the paper already. sign it so this could like be over. It's like, oh my God. And it's almost as if he's aware he's being trapped. But then, okay, and he signs it, and you're like, all right, you know, they proved their theory correct, and then it all goes to hell.
Well, you know, but even what I loved about that is, okay, you have that, but the next hurdle still could be the son, because he's an integral part of that where he calls him up and says, hey, I need to be picked up. I'm not ready. I won't be there. Okay, I need a taxi. Because even to that point, yes, it could have worked and they could have had him. But the son could have still been a wild card.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then at that point, you know, had he tipped them off, you know, I don't know, he could have a gun on him and all of a sudden, you know, it turns into a firing spree.
Yeah. Again, the way that it was played out, everything up to him getting into the cab, you're thinking, this is all good. And then all of a sudden, shit starts happening. And I don't know how you were. I was in the theater going, what the hell is going on? Like, what is going on? Like, he gets into a car crash. airbag goes off, and I was like, Jesus, what is, and he's getting out, and then you see the, and then I'm like going, oh no, he's getting effed over, like, and all the things.
Well, let me ask you this, did you suspect something was off only because when he goes outside the van to take a smoke, he sees, you know, that car. And, you know, I guess to some, and it could have been one of those things of, okay, they're just kind of checking up, you know, on us, seeing that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing in that sense. And because they obviously want to know directly and report it to whether the Americans or whoever else. But at the same time, it felt a little suspicious.
You know, maybe I was just so drawn into the movie. The way I looked at it is, this was his plan. And everybody was there when he saw the car. Everybody was there to see him fail. Mm-hmm. Like, because we know as the audience and following Gunther and his team, everything relied on Abdullah making the last minute change. And everybody was there to see whether or not his theory was true or not and what is going to happen. So being that he told, you know, being that we had that board meeting, let's call it, before, and he said, this is my plan, this is what we need to do, and this is how we got to play it out, I just figured everybody was there to ensure things were going to go down the way that Gunther had laid out the plans. What I didn't see, and I should have, I didn't see how they were there to screw him over. I think regardless of whether or not, if he didn't switch the, if he didn't swap out that last charity organization, mm-hmm. I still think they would have gotten in and mm-hmm. taken him away.
Interesting.
Yeah. I still think
that's a good theory. And yeah, I mean, in terms of the car crash, they had no regard for his safety whatsoever.
Absolutely not.
If he was going to be a casualty, they didn't care.
No. And I think, you know, you sort of kind of feel like you were in that car because things happen so fast. I was even like, what the hell is going on here? When he gets out of the car and he starts looking at all the players involved, and when that starts to seep in, and, you know, he had had that great conversation with Robin Wright Penn's character at that high-rise restaurant where they had the cocktail, and mm-hmm. she more or less said, okay, I'm going to back you. Trust me. She says, trust me. You know, I believe in you. And that's all he needed to move forward. And when you see her come out of that building, man, and she just gives him that cold, hard stare, he just got fucked. He got raped. And oh, my God. I like, when I saw that ending, I was depressed. I was angry. And at the same time, I was like, wow, I didn't
and
see
you
it coming.
I felt for him because, to me, it's not so much her. Obviously, there's the pain of that. But then he's looking at, as you mentioned earlier, that he's built up this team, and mm-hmm. while a lot of those players aren't necessarily, you know, the spies themselves, they're, you know, they've been indoctrinated into this party, and then they're very heavily involved. And obviously, the big thing is like his promises to them, and he just looks around and he does not say when he didn't say anything and just got in his car and was out. You know, you could interpret that in many ways. For me, it was just total defeat.
Oh,
I couldn't even face the music of them. Yeah, and say like, hey,
he couldn't face. Don't forget the promises that he made to the lawyer. The promises that he made to what was that character's name? The one Jamal. Mm-hmm. The promises that he made to the team. That look at this is the promises that he made to the son. That his father was not going to be harmed. That his father would not be tortured. That all this, all the promises, that everything that he promised went to hell. And how do you cope with that? And then his team who backed him, who he got to back, and he proved himself right into his team. And you're right, the defeat. And it was just not his face; it was his whole body language. He was just hunched over, gets into his car, drives away. And the final shot just says it all. He just gets out of the car. It appeared as if it was taken from either the back seat. And yeah, you see him. He gets out of the car. He's walking away from the car. And then he just walks out of frame. And the camera just, it's locked. It stays there. And you're just like, you feel as defeated.
Yeah,
as he
well,
does.
One of, you know,
amazing scene, an amazing scene.
You know, there's something to be said. If you look at the Hurt Locker, right? Not that there's a victory in that per se, but sure. at the end of the day, they accomplish their task, right? And then he comes back, but he feels emptiness, which is ironic again because they managed to accomplish their task. And there's so many other movies where, like, you whether you're so obsessed with one thing and then you finally accomplish it, and it's like, oh, what the heck do I do now?
Mm-hmm.
And this, what it did so brilliantly, taking that idea, but now reversing in the sense that it's not a win, it's a loss.
Oh.
So now imagine if you feel that awful when you've just accomplished something amazing because you have nothing to do with the rest of your life, imagine a huge loss.
Yeah. And it's most likely, and it's a victory to the other people.
Absolutely. But it's not a great victory.
It's a great victory for the other people, but not for him at all. And, you know, all his promises, everything that he fought for, they just turncoat on him and they betrayed him and they just, there you go, buddy. It's ours. It was always this way. You were a pawn in our game because this is what our goal was. And we didn't really care about your goal, but we went along just to see what happened. But we were going to end up doing whatever it is that we wanted to do. And oh, well, you already put the pasture. Maybe now you'll go away.
I want to talk, obviously we know, we've been kind of talking about him, we've been talking about the main task of all of this was to get the money, but I want to talk about, for lack of a better term, you could call him the MacGuffin, I guess, because he's, you know, Jamal, he's got the money,
mm-hmm.
he's the asset that right. we, for better or worse, got to protect, but got to get to in the early rounds. I enjoyed that part of it. You know, I mean, he basically said nothing. But they did bring a, you know, when later when it becomes William Dafoe and they're having, you know, he goes in for the first time to have that meeting, my client and all right. that. And I heard you're a trustworthy person. That's why we want to give this right. money to you. I thought it, every one of those bits beforehand worked up so well to build to that portion.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But what was your take on all that?
I love the Jamal character for this reason. At the beginning, he was set up. You do believe he's a terrorist. Something's going to explode. There was a sense of danger around him, and it wasn't the exciting kind of danger. Something bad was going to happen. As the movie progresses, and you listen to Gunter and his theories and what it is. It started to make me change my perception of that character to that being, well, maybe Gunther's right. Maybe he is innocent. Like, and it had that cloud throughout, like where to an extent, for a little while, I was guessing, is he good? Is he bad? Is he there to really perpetuate terrorism? And I guess I got so wrapped up that I did believe Gunther's theory that he was, in fact, innocent. He wasn't saying the lies about him being tortured and how he hated his father and things like that. I ended up buying into that, which made the ending for me more tragic. So again, what I really liked is just the change of heart that I had for that character from when we first see him swimming and sneaking into Germany, and you know, how he had to maneuver and be sneaky, which sets him up as a bad guy. He's a terrorist.
Yeah.
And then as the movie goes on, I'm like, maybe Gunther's really onto something. And maybe he's not a terrorist. He just wants to get he needs some semblance of asylum. What did you feel? Like, I mean,
I want to talk about this. Yeah. It's kind of touching upon that. And I hope you guys at home can appreciate and respect it and continue this conversation in a way where this is going to be more of a difficult subject.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know what I mean? So don't, whatever. I want to talk about the racism aspect of it.
Okay.
And let me say this. When I saw the movie, the audience was, it was small but diverse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was what I suspect to be people of Muslim faith watching it. There was, you know, there was me, there were some goth kids, ironically.
Really?
And yeah, it was quite a diverse viewing. And, you know, as you're mentioning this, some of the stuff, to a degree, you have to kind of examine your own self-racism and, sure. you know, be honest with yourself to say, okay, How much of am I stereotyping this based off of what I know? And I found that to be interesting. Not necessarily, perhaps it wasn't the main point of the movie, but you have to be faced with it, and you have to have that honest conversation, perhaps with yourself.
Sure. You know, Phil, that's a fantastic point, and I guess that's, you know, perhaps introspectively, you know, when you first see him, those thoughts of the profiling, the racial profiling, you know, you do instantly think he's a terrorist. Yeah. He's nothing good. He's there in town to figure out something good. And it was really interesting, too, because seeing the college professor and who he is, like, you, they did a great, maybe it's a bait and switch, the people who looked good, that, you know, had the professional jobs, who were rich, they end up being somebody completely different. And the person who is coming from the waters, who's sneaking and lurking around, I mean, I think the racial, if you're going to go racial profiling, especially to, you know, events of today going on.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of.
Especially today.
Especially today.
Today being August 8th, 2014. Right. So, and I mean, this does mark a period of history.
Absolutely.
Not that there hasn't already been.
No. And I really think you bring up a fantastic point. And, you know, I think that's why initially I think this guy's a terrorist. You know, and it's only, you know, he's presented in certain ways. And in a sense, it is a red herring. Because you are made to think that he's a bad guy. It comes into play. And now thinking about it, I think it could have been a conscious decision of the director to set that, you know, that's what he wanted to implant in his audience's head. And I think it's a good point. Be interested to see what our audience thinks.
Yeah, because, you know, to me, it was a lot of mixed signal in the sense of, you know, these people were helping him, but the people that were helping him, I didn't find too, you know, quote unquote evil.
Mm-mm.
You know, and so I didn't really get it. And if he, and then my mind went the other way. I imagine like a stereotypical Osama bin Laden, and where would he be hiding out, and how would he be protected and things like that? And I imagined it to be a lot different. So I'm like, well, that's not the typical way that I see terrorists being protected. Not, you know.
Yeah.
So he can't be all that evil, because the opposite racism and that I know is not incongruent with what's happening.
And you're right. And it takes us that extra step too, because you don't I don't want to speak for anybody. I didn't instantly change my mind on the character. Mm-hmm. Even from where in early on, you know, Gunther is like, look, he's our lead, you know, and we got to find out why he's here, but I think he's innocent. And you're like, okay, what do you got to go on that? And it's only as the movie progressed and you got to know the character a little more, especially with his interaction with Rachel McAdams, the lawyer character, then I started to switch my perception. But I do think, too, that racism card, the other people that Gunther, outside of his team that he was trying to convince, like, they were just convinced he's here for no good because he is the son of this guy and he's here to do bad. We need to stop him. We need to stop him from getting from point A to B and finishing his mission, because we can't have what happened back in 9/11. We can't have that happen again. You know, we won't survive it. So they went in with the complete racial profiling, which was going on in that day.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that, it plays a key component.
And you know, from the team's perspective, you know, one of the things it is hard, and you have to, anytime you deal with security, you have to operate from 100% level of caution.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You're guilty until proven innocent.
Right.
And that's one of that's a tough thing to do. You know, I know Maria's bodyguard, Joe, it's very tough for him to be friends with many people only because he's always eyeing and sizing up people and what's their motive and what do they really want.
Yeah.
And it takes, you know, sometimes 2 years for him to really call someone a friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's, because if they don't do that, it can have repercussions.
Yeah.
Because all it takes is that one time.
Yeah, and you get the fact, too, that Gunther is very closed.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't open up. It looks like he opens up to one person.
A drink.
Yeah, and well, but that one woman, and again, the Erna Frey is the only one that he seems to open up to, and maybe a little bit more to his team, because the team gets it. They understand him and where he's coming from. But still, he's very closed, and he has to have this appearance. And plus, it's such a solitary kind of a job when you're staking somebody out. Like, that was the other thing. There wasn't much interaction. Like, when they were on their missions, when they were trying to track down, it could be tedious, and there was the loneliness involved. And when you're dealing with a man who already has ghosts of a failed mission, and it was put on him, he's got to carry that along with him.
Yeah, I mean, to the best way I can describe some of those scenes, it's like watching paint dry with the requirement of having to be the most attentive you've ever been in your life.
All right.
Because it's a flash, yeah, of a second, and if you've missed, you know, you're reading some newspaper articles, it's not about the passage of time, it's about waiting for that glimpse of when something happens.
And to try to do the right thing. Bar scene.
Yeah.
There's that great bar scene where that guy hits the woman. But he's noticing them. He's noticing that couple before that event takes place. He's just observant. That's what he is. And when he decks her, like, just levels her, flattens her out, and he gets up to do the noble, honorable thing, and he does, and then the woman gets up and goes back into his arms again, and he's like going, I can't even be chivalrous and get that done right. But it was through his perception of just like he, like you said, like Joe does. He just notes people in the bar and you know, and he said, didn't even say something about like he almost knows everybody and their characteristics. I mean, that's what he does. But again, that just furthered when that happened. And he tries to save that woman, and you're like, all right, you felt good. And then she just gets up, and they're like, ah, piss off. And again, there was that defeat in him when he's like, good God, I can't even be a hero to somebody. It was a great scene.
It's a very lonely job. Another great movie is Wag the Dog. There's that very famous scene where Dustin Hoffman's character finally turns, and he just says, I want the credit. In the movie, the whole point is he's done all these different things, and the one thing that he can't do is claim credit for it. And at the end of the movie, that's all he wants is the credit for this. And same in this situation, like you can't get the credit.
Yeah.
Your whole job is to do something, but you can never get credit for it.
Outside of your peers. I mean, you have to
prove
to your
peers. But even then, that is so small.
It is, but, you know, again, when you look at where that character is in life, that's all he's got to hang on at this point. He has to prove to himself that he's not the wash-up that so many people look at him as. And again, it just leads to the tragedy of that character and that protagonist and how well he played him. And, you know, he was just looking for redemption.
Let me ask you this. We've talked about Philip Seymour Hoffman, and by the way, for those of you interested, we did do, at the time of the passing, we did do a Philip Seymour Hoffman tribute. So if you guys are interested in that, we talked at length about his career. Mm-hmm. It's a great listen. But how did you feel watching him on screen? Because he captivated me, but there was definitely moments where he went in and out, and I was like, he's great. And I know, but it became self-referential because I thought, okay, I know he's got Hunger Games coming out, but this is, for better, this is the last thing that he's really going to be in.
He was so good in this movie. Couple of layers. At times I felt as if I was watching a ghost because I know he's no longer with us. He was so good in this movie, and he was unlike any other role that he had done. He was like, to me, it was something that I had never seen him do before. And he played the German defeated character so well, and he had the accent down and the gravel, his gravelly voice. I thought, again, unlike anything he's played before. Felt like I was watching a ghost. It was a little bit chilling, disconcerting at times, because you know he's no longer with us. And then I felt sad and tragic, because then it made me think, I am never going to see him do another role where I can go, wow, I've never seen him as this. I've never seen him play like this before. And man, it's so tragic, because you look at a person who has so much talent within him, and he had people rooting, he had family. And it just bothered me. It was just sad because of how he died.
The part that I don't know if other people would mention, or if it, I don't know what the correlation could be, but let's take the master, right? He has more of a leadership role and things like that. In this, he plays amazing, but it's sad because it's one of his most tragic movies, and he is playing a very sad character, and you know, as that to be the last part, knowing the way in which he passed, you know, where he didn't look so good either. It's almost, it becomes too haunting and too real where the two meet, you know. Had he ended with, let's say, you know, had he been a starring role in Hunger Games, let's say, and it was actually completed, you know, and it was somewhat joyous because he's leading a rebellion, it would have a different feeling. Whereas this, he goes out with a loss.
He goes out with a loss.
And in life.
He goes out with a loss, movie and life, and he walks out of frame.
Yeah.
Never to be seen again. It literally is an ironic way in which how that movie ended. Because that's how it is. It's a loss. He walks out of frame, and we're never going to see him again. You know, it's tragedy what the addiction did to him. And it's tragic that he couldn't kick it, even though he had the support of his family and friends. I said this in our recap with him, and that's what makes me angry at the same time, because he's a talent. And for the most part, people did enjoy working with him, and they recognized his talent. And I recognized his talent in this movie. Again, because it was something that I had never seen him do before. And he completely changed his character. He was so schlumpy and so beaten. His voice, he never really yelled a lot. He had this very deep, gravelly voice.
Just at the end when he said that for...
Yeah, no, but that was the only time. But he was so defeated and broken at that point. It was just amazing. And it started, like, again, and I was just running through, you know, I remember him playing the villain in Mission Impossible 3 and how amazing he was as the villain to go up against Ethan Hunt. And it was like, wow, he was just so good. And again, I had not seen him as that type of a villain before. Like I said, the best way I can describe it, it was just as if I was watching a ghost on screen, and it was tragic and sad at times.
So again, you know, not that this was, but obviously it has to be addressed because, you know, that's what we're ultimately dealing with. I don't necessarily want to go deeper into it, only because we you know, we I think we got what we needed to out during that tribute. You know,
absolutely.
I don't think, you know, if you're really looking to go down that route as a fan right now, it's definitely worth checking out. I don't think I emotionally want to go too far
now. You know, it was, and I think that's part of this, what brings you into this movie as well. I mean, you can't ignore that and his appearance in this movie and how, you know, is this makeup? I mean, I couldn't get that out of my head, too. Not that it detracted me from the movie, don't get me wrong, and not that I focused on the movie, but his appearance in this movie was, it was meant to be ragged, I believe. But, yeah, I mean, let's talk about something that we love. Like, how did this movie come to be? How did roadside attractions and all this fun stuff? You know, this movie is pretty much, it was funded internationally. Which is very
roadside. I've never really heard of roadside attractions before.
Oh, really?
But they've got now a lot of stuff coming out within the next couple of months. And I mean, tell me more. I'm curious.
Well, roadside attractions was Lionsgate's specialty arm, and this is a time, you know, Fox has Fox Searchlight, Universal has Focus, and this is at a time of transition a bit from Lionsgate. You know, Lionsgate really, prior to getting into horror movies and the Saw movies and things like that, they made specialty movies. And as they were sort of kind of getting away from that, Roadside Attractions was somewhat born of that, so that they could have a specialty arm that could release limited release movies and do different things. One of the things that they were really noted for is the movie Margin Call that was produced by Zachary Quinto. We know him as Spock. This was one of the first movies to attempt to do a to be released theatrically and then go on VOD. And, you know, some people praise it. Others have criticized it because the movie theatrically did really well. They did a good job. Roadside marketed it really well. They released a good movie. You had Zachary Quinto behind it. You had a decent cast. And some people say, had they not gone the VOD route, they were leaving money on the table. But it was one of those first movies that captured the attention of the business, the industry, for doing that sort of thing. They you know, you should look at their resume. They have a lot of movies out.
They got a lot of movies coming out.
Coming out, too.
Yeah.
And they did the Kristen Wiig movie that came out shortly after Bridesmaids.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the title. Please forgive me. But, yeah, they are a specialty arm of Lionsgate. When I saw the movie, you know, Lionsgate logo came up first, which I thought was sort of a cheat. It should have been Roadside Attractions. Like, it was, a, you know, Roadside does the marketing. I've worked with some of their marketing folks before. They have good people over there. And I like the way that they, I like the way that they think. They definitely can fit into the Lionsgate mold. But yet, I do enjoy the fact that the people who work at Roadside are movie lovers. And they love this type of a movie. And it's because of them that we get this type of a movie. So in the making of this movie, you know, this could have been a bigger studio. Like maybe Focus could have done it, Fox Searchlight or whatever. You know, but this one, definitely, this is a lower budget venture. It was mostly funded internationally. That's what, you know, that's how they got their funding to make this movie. And believe it or not, Roadside picked this up by seeing 5-minute footage in Cannes, and they embraced it so much, and they thought, we've got something here, and they picked it up. I love that kind of spirit. I love that.
I love, you know, also in terms of the actors, you know, what I love is, I think, you know, Willem Dafoe, obviously Philip Seymour Hoffman, and even Rachel McAdams.
I didn't even know Willem Dafoe was in the movie.
Yeah,
until he showed up, I was like, "What?"
But I have, what I appreciate is they have this spirit to just want to do something different and artistic, for lack of a better term,
because
you could certainly call this artistic.
Sure.
And you know, for them, it wasn't about the paycheck; they just wanted to do something that was worthy.
They had a good story, and look at Willem Dafoe this year. He was in Moonrise, Grand Budapest Hotel, which he was great. So like, good for him. And like I said, it was a pleasant surprise to see him. He was the only American, in the movie. His character was American as well, the banker. So I think that, you know, when you get a small little studio that backs a movie like this, they did a decent job. I mean, we still have landmark theaters.
I think, you know, especially with these types of movies, you can tell that there's a passion. You can, I remember this. I don't actually remember, but the Smell-O-Vision theaters.
Oh, absolutely.
You can smell the passion of this movie without even that. You can, because trust me, there's movies that perhaps we've talked about off air that you can tell that it was made because it had to be made rather than someone really wanted to make it.
Right.
And here, all these ingredients come together because people wanted to do it.
Absolutely. And, you know, to the credit of Roadside, Howard Cohen, and his partner wanting to release this movie, getting Lionsgate to like say, "Hey, this is, we can do good with this." And so far, they've been doing okay. I don't necessarily have a breakdown. This is one of those movies where
I think they're at, I don't know, is it 7 million?
They're over seven. I'm going to say they're about 7.5. They're on their way to 8. You know, unfortunately, because it is a limited release movie, They don't necessarily disclose what the budget is, and because it was financed foreign, I don't know what the budget was.
I certainly appreciate that they're not marking Mark. While we have talked about it, it is Philip Seymour Hoffman's last, you know, full.
You can't get around that.
But they also haven't used that as like, hey, go see this.
Yes, because of
it would have been exploitative, mm-hmm. and it would have been befitting A, of him, but B, the movie.
Yeah, I think they went more the Smiley's people route. Mm-hmm. Let's focus on that we have Philip Seymour Hoffman in this movie. Let's focus on that it's this type of a spy movie that if you go see this, you're going to see a good performance. There's going to be some suspense. You're going to be entertained. And it's going to be anti what you've been going to all summer. And it's gonna afford you something different, a different slice of movie pie that
you got to turn on your brain this time,
right? And just sit down, right? And look, it had a, you know, when it opened up in July 14th, it opened up at 361 locations. Currently, it's about 726. So, mm-hmm. and they're considering that wide, you know, 90% on Rotten Tomatoes. CinemaScore doesn't. For good or for bad, they don't pay attention to smaller movies like this. But when you get a 90% rating, you know, you sort of kind of wonder too, because you could have easily exploited the Philip Seymour Hoffman aspect of this movie. And from my perspective, I was wondering whether or not, because it happens, sometimes a critic will give a gift to a movie knowing that it's mm-hmm. this performer's last movie. And the movie might not be that good, but they'll say he went out with, you know, not in this case. I think this case, the critics, because when I saw it, I was pleasantly surprised. I do think it's one of his better performances. The movie works. And I loved, like, the whole story, like, the director the director of this movie, Anton Corbijn. Pardon me if I messed up his last name. You know, he actually met Philip Seymour. He's a photographer mm-hmm. by trade, but he also filmed another great spy movie called The American. It's a really good movie, deliberately paced movie that is about character. And this is what this movie is about. This movie is about character, suspense, building suspense. And he met Philip Seymour Hoffman a little while prior. He was doing a photo shoot and he just thought that he would have been perfect for this role. I love the sense, and again, I didn't know this until I read this. The movie was primarily shot on a handheld. Did you know that? I mean, I didn't, there were scenes, but I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly not a Michael Bay movie where it's just the camera moved everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the most part, I mean, yeah, it was shaky, but it wasn't, you know, shaky enough for me to be like, oh, wow.
Yeah, the movie was shot on a handheld, and it gave it the
Do you know
movie.
What camera?
That I do that not know. No,
that's all right.
Unfortunately, I'm sorry. I don't. That I mean, don't
it,
know.
It looked, it looked great.
It looked really good.
I mean, him as a photographer, obviously he's directing. So, but you know, we've made point of how visually arresting it is.
Yeah.
You could take a screenshot of probably any moment in the movie and hang it up on your wall because it's a great image.
And you know he. Again, he'll even admit, you know, it was all about tonality. Mm-hmm. He goes on in an interview and, you know, he wanted the film to look different. This movie does not look like The American. It doesn't look like that movie a lot. This one's drab. American was in Italy, I think. So it's okay. You can yawn. Am I putting you to sleep? Am I putting you to sleep, audience?
No, you're good.
But like we said, like I wanted a loose feeling with this film. We did handheld camera to get more urgency in the film, which works, especially in the car scene, that car chase, or when they're trying to follow Rachel McAdams. And that was a great scene. By nature, I guess, when you do handheld, you have less control over the composition, so it looks less composed. I didn't necessarily think so. I thought that led to this movie's beauty, in a sense. But he says, I still think it looks very beautiful, but different feel to it than any other of my films. I think the movie, we talked about, this movie does look beautiful. I think it helps that he was a photographer. He didn't get pretentious with his shots. He didn't do any camera trickery to say, ooh, look at me, I'm a director, I'm an independent director, and I'm going to put the camera upside down. He didn't do any of that at all. And that's why, to an extent, I felt that Germany was, as you said, as much a character. as like Sweden was in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, because it's all in the way in which he filmed everything. He did a great job, I think. I hope that everybody who was with us is, I hope they think the same way. If there's any differing opinion, I'm dying to know and hear about it. But yeah, I mean, it lends, and again, it just lends to the atmosphere of defeat. You know,
yeah, it was not pleasant.
There's not a bright spot in the movie. When you think about it, there really isn't a sunny day that I can recall that stuck out to me. Right?
Not at all. No. None whatsoever.
So, yeah, I think that, he accomplished what he set out to do. He's also, the director too has said, yeah, I've wanted to retire, but, you know, I felt I could make a good movie out of this story that John Le Carré, he was his source material.
I mean, hey, we did Begin Again. It's always nice that when you can find your muse and get back into what you're doing, and that's what Begin Again is all about. And
yeah.
I love that movie in particular because of that.
Yeah.
So that's actually great to hear that you found this project and it re-inspired him.
Yeah, and, you know, working, again, for him, you sort of kind of feel bad for anybody involved with this movie, too, because first thing they're going to be asked is...
What was it like?
He said he was fine. He did what he was hired to do, and I appreciate it for his artistic thing. You know, he didn't mistreat anybody, and you know, he was fine. He was good. So, you know, I don't think it didn't take away when I was researching this movie. Yes, I read a lot about Philip Seymour Hoffman, and they even interviewed John Le Carré, who was like. Yeah, he was great. And, you know, it doesn't take away from this movie.
Yeah.
And they didn't, as we talked earlier, didn't exploit.
Is there anything else you want to talk about? I know maybe music. It's such an understated thing in this. We just did Guardians of the Galaxy, so if you have seen that, check that out. But with that, obviously there's a huge soundtrack to it. With this... everything plays in unison, but it's all individually so understated.
Yeah, and it wasn't...
Unless you're really looking for the pieces, you won't be able to see them.
Yeah, I felt how music was used in this. Usually in a suspense flick like this, you will get music to accompany the scene to heighten the suspense. There was music in this, but I can't honestly recall... Any particular scene?
There was a lot of use of piano,
yeah.
From what I remember, which played, which tied in because remember finally like the night before I think it is, and you know he's looking at the piano,
right?
So it tied in that way. There was that connection to him, and so I felt overall the music had a tone of him.
Yeah, but at the same time, like you know, I talk about score a lot. This wasn't anything, when they let a suspense scene play out, they let the scene play out. You weren't bombarded with a big score or anything to heighten it, which is fine in certain movies, but I think in this, the understatedness of this movie.
Yeah. Because I get what you're saying. There's definitely movies that, you know, a lot of times, it'd be a fun exercise for those listening. Check out a movie and see if there's a musical cue right before you're supposed to get sad, happy, or whatever. Because usually the music comes just right before it.
Yeah. So I find that very interesting. So,
well, I think that about does it for us here today.
Yeah.
There's not much else that we need to discuss. For those of you at home that we do want to discuss more, definitely let us know. We comment, you know, one of the great things is that film is forever. And so, hey, if you're watching or listening in 2059 and you still want to talk about this movie, hopefully we'll still be around to answer your comments.
Yeah, for good or for bad, we're immortalized. Or I'm immortalized for good or for bad, but thanks for watching.
You know, I mean, the most encouraging thing that we've continued to see is the fact that, there's we've been doing this not for too long, but quite enough a bit where we've built up an arsenal of shows. And you guys are commenting on stuff that we've done from the very beginning, some of it just now. And so it's great to see that. A lot of movies now are coming out on Blu-ray, whether Noah... What was the other one I was mentioning? 300 Rise of an Empire. Right. So these are movies that we've covered. So if you're just getting into them now, it's great. And it's funny for me looking back on the stuff that we did, because now you get the Blu-rays, you get the special behind the scenes. It's always fun to see all the stuff you didn't know and you still miss, despite whatever amount of research that we did, despite whatever, you guys added to the conversation through comments. You know, it's a film is a continuous journey. There's
it really is. And you can always go back. You know, I have to bring up Under the Skin.
That's been a great show.
I mean,
show
this
for
movie,
us.
It's been such a, you know, it was such a, it was an interesting show for us to record and put down. The life that this movie has had with home entertainment, VOD, Blu-ray, or whatever, I think has spawned more views. But you're right. We've been doing this for about a year. My first film was Pacific Rim. What I've noticed is a great growth in our team. There's a comfortability factor, and I think I'm hoping that transcends to be on the camera to everybody who's listening to us. They get that rhythm and comfort as well. That maybe, who knows? I think it would be hysterical if somebody actually talked back to their earbuds, going, "Nah, I don't believe with that. Dimitri's an idiot."
Some might be doing that.
Yeah,
I've seen some of the comments.
Yeah, that's true. So, but that's great.
Hey, you know what? For better or worse, be honest.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than being dishonest.
That's true.
So we appreciate it for better or worse. Yeah, thank you guys absolutely. For listening. It's been wonderful. Let us know your thoughts. And for better or worse, this is the starring role, certainly, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm very curious to see him in Hunger Games, Mockingjay. So we'll obviously touch upon him then. The journey continues, my friends. Dimitri does have a Twitter.
Oh boy, yeah, I'm still trying to figure it out. I think of the 9 people who are following me, 5 have blocked me already because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. But yes, it is at dmovies1701. So at dmovies1701, follow me, comment, be kind, be nice. I'll even write you back. Yeah, hopefully I don't do anything silly where you would think to block me. I try to be polite. I understand there's a Twitter etiquette, which I'm really trying to uphold.
Teach Dimitri the Twitter etiquette.
I'm still learning how to press the buttons and how to retweet properly and how to tweet certain people, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. That's just the bottom line.
All right, guys, and follow us here on Movie Anatomy on Twitter, Movie Anatomy. anatomyofamovie.com, and we've got a lot of great dissections coming up. We've got Into the Storm, we've got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. As mentioned, we just did Guardians of the Galaxy. Last week we did Boyhood, we did Lucy, and Wish I Was Here. There's a whole library. Check it out. Thank you guys for being with us. Thank you.
Thanks all.
On behalf of Josh the Engineer, Dimitri Panos, and why not, Sarah Stratton, John Comerford, Chloe West, Marissa Serafini, who couldn't be here today. We thank you. We'll be here next time.
Absolutely.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.